Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Bringing together some 115 photographs from across four decades of the artist's career, Sally Mann, A Thousand Crossings, offers both a sweeping overview of her achievement and a focused exploration of the continuing influence of the American South on her work. In her keynote address for a public symposium held in conjunction with the exhibition, Grace Elizabeth Hale explores how return, as a practice, a process, a subject, and an aesthetic, structures time and thus marks and makes history. Hale discusses how Sally Mann and other photographers working in the South employ return to render history visible, the way they photograph the same place or people or event, restage old images or return to places photographed by others, employ old photographic processes, formats, and materials, and consciously go back to former histories, to older Souths, to the lies that pass for truth, and to the relationships people constructed with these paths. What, Hale asks, can the work of these photographers tell us about the changing meaning of history? This program is made possible by the James D. and Catherine K. Steele Fund for Photography.
Welcome. Thank you for daring to come into this dark auditorium on such a beautiful day. I just want to thank the brilliant Sarahs, Sarah Greeno and Sarah Kennel, for inviting me here today. I also want to thank Sean Smith. I don't know if she's here, but she was the first person to ask me to think about this topic of return in relation to photography in the South. And I also want to thank Bill Wiley. The errors are mine, but he certainly saved me from many of them. So thank you, Bill. So I just want to start by suggesting some of the many things that return can mean. Return means coming back to a place that grounds you, that is the ground. It means rooting yourself in a context, in a geography, and a community. It means to say or put or send or feel or give back your attention or your presence or your affection or your verdict. It means to yield or to make. So part one of my talk is called A Circular Opening. The photographer Emmett Gowan's attention to the cycles of life, to the circle as a form, and to his wife Edith are a good place to begin thinking about return in relation to photography and the South. I've been to Emmett and Edith Gowan's place about half a dozen times now, the road-in cluster of white wooden houses in Danville, my own version of return. After an almost 20-year history, deconstructing romanticisms in the name of history, or I should have said career, sorry, perhaps the single most important thread through all of my intellectual work, I come back like the moths drawn to the light behind the bedsheet, the insects that Emmett Gowan catches and pins in his current body of work. When I visit, Emmett and Edith are always present, and some shifting configuration of Edith's family stops by, the sisters May and Helen and Ruth and their husbands and children and grandchildren. The web of Danville family is complicated, rich, and deep. Almost half a century after Emmett began making serious photographs of his wife Edith's Danville family, this tangle of people and houses remain the place where Emmett makes his art, even when he is photographing other subjects, the place that inspires him. Together, he and Edith and their family in this place have returned a body of photographs that have something to tell us about not just the history of photography, but about how photography can help us think about history. Gowan calls this image on the screen now Nancy, Danville, Virginia, 1965. He also calls it his first real photograph. He was about 3 weeks into graduate school at the Rhode Island School of Design when he received induction papers and went to Danville to talk to his draft board. His four-year-old niece, Nancy, in his words, quote, assigned him to take a photograph of her lying on the ground with her seven favorite dolls. Thinking about Vietnam, not even sure that his borrowed film holders were loaded, he made this image. The sun is low in the fall sky here. Nancy lies on a tarp of dark black plastic whose folds reflect the light. Her dolls, naked and in various states of dress, tumble about her, their legs and sometimes bellies exposed, their movable eyes closed, their painted eyes staring up, or in one case, at the camera. The long black shadows of the tripod and Gowan's legs cut diagonally up from Nancy's cowboy boots across the lower frame. The ground is a tracery of sticks and vines. Nancy's eyes, like many of the dolls, are closed against the sun, and she covers one with both her fingers. Her uplifted elbow pulls up her dress. Nancy Danville, Virginia, offers an alternative reality to Vietnam. Another kind of flesh on the ground, bodies touching the black plastic of bags, limbs tumbled about, eyes closed or staring, clothes askew. At Gowan's meeting with his draft board afterward, officials suggested he ask for conscientious objector status, which he later won. 2 years later, Edith Danville, Virginia, 1967, was made in Edith's grandmother's house, where Gowan, Edith, and their baby son, Elijah, were spending Christmas with her family. Hoping to capture something about what his domestic life was like then, Gowan returned to his favorite subject. In a story the artist has often told, a student at Princeton, where he later taught, asked him how many photographs of Edith he had made. He answered, "Not enough." In this 1967 Edith, return is subtly visible everywhere. In the ritual of visiting family, holiday cards received each year and taped to the doorframe, the baby bottle on the mantle that suggests the presence of the couple's child and the cycle of life, even the cases of returnable Coke bottles stacked on the kitchen floor. Yet like the picture of Nancy and her dolls, this image of domesticity and intimacy, in Gowan's words, quote, lived with Vietnam. In the Danville family images, Gowan created an intimate alternative to an American history of escalating war. Around the same time, Gowan began using a lens too small for his 8x10 view camera. In order to create standard size images, he cut the rectangle out of the circle. By 1970, he began thinking about the dark edges outside the circle as interesting, as a space of transition. The circle transformed these edges into a concaved curved space that pulled the viewer in to intimate interior scenes, or alternately pushed the viewer out at exterior scenes like landscapes. The circle echoed the eye and provided a portal, a window, into the matriarchal family circle and the grouping of Danville houses. And the vignette effect made the photographs look instantly old, pushing against any easy comparison of them with family snapshots. 4 years later, Gowan took this photograph, Edith Christmas, Danville, Virginia, 1971. It's Edith again, Christmas again, and Danville again, the rituals of going home for the holidays, putting up the tree and the decorations, selecting and wrapping and unwrapping the gifts. The circle suggests a peephole, a view inside a sheltered and yet also subtly erotic space. The outline of Edith's body is visible through the white nightgown as she stands in the front of the window, her hair overexposed, her body on the right melting into light. On the floor, almost lost amongst the ripped paper, little Elijah makes the cars on his racetrack go around and around. 2 years later, Gowan hauled his camera into the kids' treehouse and shot View of Rennie Boer's House, Danville, Virginia, 1973. In the South, where snow is rare, probably this applies to DC as well, but in the South where snow is rare, taking these kinds of photographs is a ritual, making these kinds of landscapes paradoxically common. Here, Gowan's circle becomes a telescope we use to peer through the tree limbs and across the field returning to scrub, to the little house and outbuildings in the distance. From the treehouse, Gowan remembers, quote, how beautiful the place was. The family's lives had been poured into that piece of land, and the land was what was left as the older generation died. Taking this photograph changed his ideas of what an intimate image could be and formed a, quote, natural end, end quote, of the Danville project. As a form, the circle pulled him outward in widening rings, away from the close-ups of people, into the yard and woods, up into the trees, and in later bodies of work, into the sky, where he shot the round, curved forms of pivotal irrigation systems, water treatment plants, and bomb craters. The circle of Gowan's Danville images presents an alternative kind of public history. Coming back, revisiting, reimagining, and repeating become ways to register the history of this family and its relation to the history of art and the larger history of the U.S. in the late 60s and 70s. Gowan's care, both his emotional connection and his craft, elevate what critics at first panned as a, quote, snapshot aesthetic into a vision of what remains of beauty and goodness in a world at war, of the transcendence on offer through everyday human intimacy. Gowan's practice of making art with his extended family, in turn, transforms their private world into something monumental, something to value, something, in his words, on par with the biblical subjects of Renaissance painting. His images make this working-class white Southern family into the subject both of art and of history. So this is part two. It's entitled, Go Back to the Beginning and Start Again. It may seem impossible, given climate change and ISIS, mass shootings and growing inequality and disregard for black life, sexual assault and Russian hacking and the opioid epidemic, to worry about any other single thing. But history, I want to say to you today, is also in trouble. I do not mean history as content. Television shows like The Deuce and The Crown, films like Mudbound and Dunkirk take place in the past. Books about the founding fathers and the Civil War continue to sell. Football coaches teach bored high school students history in classes all across the country. And some people actually get tickets to Hamilton, though I'm not one of them. No, the problem with history is not content. The problem is form. Linear stories, those no longer tenable grand narratives of progress and decline, play now as fantasy fiction, as Star Wars films, video games, and the stories alt-right guys tell themselves to explain their anger. There are simply too many strands, too many pasts, too many people and places to understand history as moving in unison. Alternately, the flatness of our always present digital backlist of sounds, images, stories, and styles pulled from multiple places and eras makes it hard to experience history as the feeling of being alive within the stream of time. History, meaning the change we are living through and making, is working against history, as historians understand the term, the meaning that emerges from understanding context, contingency, and causation. Or to put this another way, all of our content is erasing our form. And this is why we need art more than ever now, because artists make us think deeply about form. For photographers making work in the world rather than the studio, the U.S. South has been a rich place to make images. At odds with the grand story of America as expanding freedom, at once the national reservoir of cultural authenticity and the national cesspool of white supremacy, the region's contradictions give artists a lot to look at. Because the South was understood as a problem during the Depression, the Farm Security Administration, famously now, sent photographers out to document the region. The work of Marion Post Wolcott, Dorothea Lange, Ben Shahn, Jack Delano, and Walker Evans, just to name some, made the work they made in the South taught viewers to see the region as somehow partially outside of then contemporary time, as a place where the past coexisted with the present. In this 1936 Walker Evans photograph of a country store, contemporary advertisements for Coke and other products jostle for space on the worn facade of an already old-fashioned wooden building with a false front. In another 1936 Evans photograph of a street in Vicksburg, Mississippi, signs push Coke Camel cigarettes and 666 cold preparation, and electricity meters adorn the unpainted wood siding of an old warehouse or shed converted into a black barbershop. Working in the South and elsewhere, FSA photographers shaped a kind of documentary practice that dominated American photography for decades. The point I want to make here is that the South is not just a major site of U.S. history from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. It is also an essential location in the history of photography. An admittedly partial list of photographers who have made important work in and about the U.S. South might start with Marion Post Wolcott and Walker Evans, Clarence John Laughlin and Ralph Meatyard, Eudora Welty and Gordon Parks, Emmett Gowan, William Christenberry, and William Eggleston. Sally Mann, of course, but also Carrie Mae Weems, who you can also see in the museum here, Deborah Luster, and Susan Lipper. In much of this work, artists employ return to render the forms of history visible. They photograph the same place or people or things at different times. They restage old images or return to places photographed by others. They employ old photographic processes, formats, and materials. And they consciously go back to former histories, to older Souths, and to the relationships people have constructed with these pasts. In their work, return as practice, as process, as subject, and as an aesthetic structures time, and in this way, marks and makes history. How we understand and give form and meaning to change over time become as much the subjects of this work as what is on the other side of the lens. Photography, of course, always shows us history as content. Every image is a representation of a moment in the past. But photography can also show us history as form, how the past gives rise to the present and sets up the possibility of the future. Alone, a single photograph cannot tell us much about this kind of history. A photograph needs context. That context can be indexicality, the relationship of the photograph to the world, or that context can be visual culture, the photograph's relation to other images, including, of course, other photographs. Context enables comparison. History is one of the meanings that can be produced by this gap between a photograph and its subject, or a photograph and another image, or even another photograph. Yet even a single photograph can help us practice a conceptual skill that is necessary and essential if we're going to think historically. To understand the relationship between past and present, we have to imagine both sameness and difference simultaneously. How people in a different time and place are both like and unlike us. Like history, photography as a medium asks us to think with rather than through a contradictory sameness and difference. The photograph has a documentary function in registering a world outside the camera, where something has to exist to reflect the light. And yet the photograph is also always a representation. It is not a piece of the world like a fossil, but an index, a reference. History is one of the meanings that can be produced at this juncture of sameness and difference. So this is part three. The place that grounds you. It was my Mississippi grandfather that taught me to love history. His stories about the past transformed the buggy cow pastures and swampy woods of Jeff Davis County, Mississippi, into a dense and magical landscape layered with traces of the people, buildings, and relationships that had come before. Driving the backwoods, he would point out the open window of his GMC truck to a spot where the jonquils bloomed in a line in an empty field and conjure the now vanished farm with his words. Or he would stop suddenly and pull onto the sandy shoulder of a dirt road and say, "I think this is it." Bushwhacking back through the tangle of blackberry bushes and scrub, he would uncover a choked spring he remembered from his youth. Miraculously, to this city girl at least, we would kneel and drink the clear, delicious water straight from that muddy ground. The next summer, when I left my parents' house in suburban Atlanta and visited again, we would drive the same circuit. We would return. By holding place still, revisiting a spot in the present and telling me stories about its multiple pasts, my grandfather opened up the layers of history like an archaeologist at a dig. He taught me to see passing time. I first understood that the artist William Christenberry, too, had these grandparent summers when I took my twin daughters, then about 6 or 7, to the Smithsonian American Art Museum's show of the artist's photographs, paintings, and constructions, aptly titled Passing Time. A single parent, I had a brilliant strategy for seeing art: the free Smithsonian plus bribery. The girls would consent to look at those boring pictures on the wall for exactly 27 minutes. If rewarded with rides on the carousel and trips to see the dinosaurs, gyms, and airplanes. But when we entered the Christenberry exhibit, their eyes lit up and they literally waved their hands in glee. Almost instantly, they seemed to understand that the sculptures, photographs, paintings, and drawings of buildings presented both sameness and difference, the world outside the self, and our imagination of that world. The way they talked about what made this art magical to them reminded me of summer drives with my Mississippi grandfather. They were seeing history. Christenberry's Jeff Davis County was, of course, Hale County, Alabama, where he spent summers on his own grandparents' farms. From 1968, when he took a job teaching at the Corcoran College of Art and Design in DC, until his health began to decline in the early 2000s, Christenberry made regular trips back to Alabama. There, he photographed structures he loved. Back in DC, he printed his images and produced sculptures and paintings of these buildings as well. Though he worked in multiple mediums, returning to this place he loved was his photographic practice, the only place he made serious pictures. Hale County was, of course, already famous in photography for the work that Walker Evans made there in collaboration with the writer James Agee, later published in the book Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. In 1935, Evans shot this general store at a crossroads town in Sprott, Alabama, in Perry County, next door to Hale. In 1936, he also took this photograph of a church. Christenberry met Walker Evans in the early 1960s, and the older photographer became the younger man's friend and mentor. About a decade later, Christenberry discovered a building standing alone in the Talladega National Forest in Hale County. Christenberry loved the way someone had put artificial brick siding on the door of the house as well as the walls. Either a good sense of humor or desperation, something to cover that door with. In 1974, he used his Brownie camera to make a photograph of this building that he dropped off at a drugstore for development. About a decade later, he took this photograph that he titled, quote, Red Building in the Forest. In 1984 and 85, he used his photographs and his memory to construct a sculpture of the building. In 2000, he made a painting of the same structure. In this same period, he made a series of images and a sculpture called Green Warehouse, New Bern, Alabama. So I'll just quickly show you. Here's a collage of images of the Green Warehouse. And here's that building as a sculpture. And then here is a painting that Christenberry also did of the Green Warehouse. So Christenberry really makes return literal. He even returned to places that Evans had photographed. That Sprott Church in particular drew his attention. In an interview, he describes discovering the church while driving his VW from DC to his parents' house in Alabama with his wife and their infant. In this photograph he made in 1971, the dry air of winter produced a deep blue sky. In 74 and 75, he made a sculpture of Sprott Church, using his photographs and thumbnail sketches he had made of the sides and back of the building. He also continued to return to make photographs, including this image from 1981. In an interview, the artist described how he loved this building. He loved the way it sat isolated and proud in the landscape, and he loved the rare symmetry of those twin towers. Sprott Church, he asserted, was, quote, the most beautiful piece of vernacular church architecture, end quote, that he had ever seen. By the time he took this 1990 photograph, the towers he loved so much were gone. So he made this sculpture, Sprott Church Memory, in 2005, to return again to that original form. In these and similar bodies of work, Kristen Berry explored, in his words, the effects of, quote, time, mankind, and the elements, end quote, on the vernacular structures he loved. Like annual pictures of school kids, his photographs revealed his subjects aging. Paint and siding faded and were sometimes replaced. Trees and vines grew and were sometimes cut. Foundations settled, roofs caved in, walls fell in. And yet Kristen Berry kept coming back and documenting what remained, making art as an act of preservation. This place is so much a part of me, I can't escape it, he said, and I have no desire to escape it. His work, in his words, was, quote, a love affair, a lifetime of involvement with the place. This place is my muse, end quote. But over time, as Kristen Berry's trips continued, the act of return became as much his subject as the structures themselves. Retracing his own paths in and around Hale County began to function as a kind of ritual practice, a way to give his attachment to place a concrete form. The photographs, in this sense, function as evidence of his act of worship, of this pilgrimage. Kristen Berry's art shows us how a grounding in place enables people to see history, to live within and think deeply about the flow of time. Circling back may seem like a contradiction, but in fact, this return is what makes forward movement possible. It's worth remembering that Kristen Berry did not love his particular southern place blindly. He faced his region's violent white supremacy in another body of work that he circled back to repeatedly in his career, his Klan Room tableau. Photographs of this work do not even begin to capture the installation's dark and terrible beauty. And I almost didn't even want to put one in the exhibition because I just don't think they convey what the installation is like if you ever have a chance to see it in person. So photographs don't convey the installation's dark and terrible beauty. They don't convey its exploration of the intersection between boys playing with war toys, fraternal organizations, a love of uniforms, and a violent sense of white male entitlement. Somehow, the materiality of Kristen Berry's work reproduces the Klan's smirking silliness, its graphic brilliance, and its nauseating violence. As the alt-right engages in its own forms of return, a fascist cosplay that we only wish was the past, Kristen Berry's Klan Room looks horribly, brilliantly new again. So this is part four, Myth and Southern History. Family, place, terrible beauty, and the burden of history. I have taken you on this brief exploration of return as a concept and a practice and an aesthetic in order to bring us back to Sally Mann. I have made my own pilgrimage to the farm on the Maury River outside Lexington, the place where Mann made the family pictures in the 1980s and early 90s, and where she lives and has her studio today. I'm not, as I said, a Virginia native. I grew up with Georgia's red dirt hills where wild dogwoods and azaleas bloom under pine trees. So I really think I can claim objectivity on this point. With rolling pastures swaddled in the green velvet of spring grass and vistas filled with the stacked and pleated foothills and small mountains of the Blue Ridge, Man's Place is a prime example of the particular beauty of Virginia farmland. The place where Man now lives, a house surrounded by a circling veranda that she and Larry built on the hill above the river, could not be more different than Emmett Gowan's white wood-framed Danville house and still occupy the same state. But these places play a similar role and in that way are also connected to Kristen Berry's Hale County. They are the places where these important artists are grounded. They are the places these artists return. Like Gowan in his Danville and Edith pictures, Mann combines the intimacy of family photographs with the formal rigors of art. Occasionally, Mann seems to revisit Gowan like Kristen Berry revisits Evans. Her photograph of Virginia with grass clippings stuck all over her moist skin, fallen child, is not a little literal return. In relation to Gowan's Nancy and Dwayne, an image that Gowan made in 1971, Mann's subject is, of course, a different child, different grass, a different decade, and an immediate rather than an extended family. But this reworking of Gowan's subject makes us look past the content of this image to its form, to its existence as art. Like Gowan's family pictures, Mann's immediate family images are about the history of art and photography as much as they are about family. She tackles myth-making, a troubled tradition in Southern history, on an intimate and personal scale. The world she as a mother and as an artist made with her children during their summers by the river. As the artist confessed to a journalist in a 1992 interview, quote, "I don't remember the things other people remember from their childhoods. Sometimes I think the only memories I have are those that I've created around photographs of me as a child. Maybe I'm creating my own life," end quote. As a mother, Mann makes this practice more self-conscious and deliberate, collaborating with her children, Emmett, Jesse, and Virginia, in, quote, "spinning the story," end quote. Using a shallow focus, sometimes placing a tube around the lens to produce a vignette effect, and directing her children's gestures and expressions, Mann fictionalizes family photographs and distances her art from documentary's more direct relationship with the world. In the most powerful of these images, like the ditch on display in the show at the National Gallery, the mythic and the documentary coexist. We see the cycle of life and also Emmett and his friends playing at the river's edge in the heat and sand of summer. In place of Gowan's alternate history in relation to Vietnam, then, Mann gives us an alternate history of parents and children. All mothers, her work suggests, are artists of sorts, with access to a ferocious power to make the world of their children that we often domesticate and deny with sentimentalism. And yet, despite this power, mothers do not have complete control. Kids have their own bodies and mind. The world is out there. Injuries happen. Magic alternates with danger. Like Gowan, Mann eventually backed away from her family scenes and out into the landscape that surrounded them. In bodies of work entitled Deep South and Last Measure, Mann's use of old photographic technologies makes myth and history not just what happened in the past, but what is remembered as important and the effect of these memories on the present, as much the subject of her work as the people and the places on the other side of the lens. When Mann turned in the mid-90s, to landscapes, she began to experiment with alternate film types and technologies. In the late 90s, she learned an old process, coating glass plates with sticky collodion. I'm not gonna put that up yet, sorry. I'm gonna leave it on this one. with coating glass plates with sticky collodion to hold light-sensitive chemicals in order to produce negatives that must be exposed and developed in the 10 or 15 minutes or so before the material dries. Photographers like Alexander Gardner had used the same wet plate process to make their now famous images of Civil War battlefields at sites like Antietam and Cold Harbor. Shooting with collodion, Mann has said, enabled her to create photographs with, quote, the appearance of having been torn from time itself, end quote. With newer papers and the large size of the prints, however, Mann is making clear that her work is not mere historical reenactment. Even though the photographs that she's making with these processes look instantly old. When she begins to invite the kind of flaws and accidents that 19th century photographers considered failures, she adds yet another layer of history, a look that suggests that her negatives have also been ravaged by the past. These effects reflect the way the passage of time itself increases the distance between all photographs and their subjects. In these ways, Mann highlights the intermediate set of decisions and actions between the world and the camera, the hand of the artist. In the National Gallery show, the room titled The Land collects images of Virginia farmland, like the one that I showed at the beginning of this part, and the Deep South scenes. Landscapes on which antebellum plantations have left their marks have been shot by photographers like Walker Evans, Eudora Welty, Clarence John Laughlin, Carrie Mae Weems, and others. Mann's doubling, old subjects and old processes, work as a metaphor for the history of history, or the way change over time is not just something that happens to people and societies and photographs, but also something that happens to our accounts of the past. Romanticism, then, is not so much the effect of Mann's images, but their subject. In Deep South Untitled, or The Valentine Windsor, a 1998 Mann photograph that's on display in the show here, she revisits a scene previously photographed by others. This is a shot that Clarence John Laughlin made of that same ruin in 1941. Here is a picture that Eudora Welty made of that ruin the next year. And I'll just draw your attention, in case you're missing it, to the wonderful shadow of Welty herself in the foreground. So by the time Mann came to this scene in 1998, it was, in fact, not just an important scene in Southern history, but also an important scene in photography. And Mann made her own image there. In that image, the ghostly heart-shaped leaves bleached out by the haunting heart-shaped light flutter between bare brick columns. The ruined negative, the crack that runs through the right column, the emulsion that peels around the edges, the drops and puddles made by the wayward chemicals, echo the broken houses and the ruinous dreams of real-life versions of Faulkner's Thomas Sutpen. Not titling these images, Mann, of course, is refusing any documentary function. What she is after here is myth. Still, without specifics like the parenthetical, quote, Emmett Till riverbank that is attached to this image, Deep South Untitled, we would have no way to know that this muddy and overexposed rut leading into a murky river is a site where some people believe the lynched boy's body was found. And we have to know this detail, as well as information provided by the wall text about a related image, Deep South Untitled Bridge on the Tallahatchie, to know that this is the rusty bridge where Till's body was probably heaved into the river. Romanticism alone, then, is just too risky. Telling us what these sites are in the world makes visible that African Americans were killed to achieve these white Southern dreams of mastery. Most African American viewers will not need to be reminded of this violence. Yet in giving landscapes of black loss an aesthetic treatment traditionally reserved for white nostalgia, Mann suggests a powerful kind of artistic reparations. In a room called Last Measure, for me, the highlight of the show, Mann turns again to an important subject in the history of photography, Civil War battlefields. In the early 2000s, Mann visited sites like Antietam and Cold Harbor, landscapes in which thousands of Americans had lost their lives. And of course, here she evokes the wartime images made by Gardner and other photographers. But as she does this, she really extends her experimentation with collodion almost into abstraction. So here is one of the Gardner Civil War battlefield photographs, and then here is another image from the Civil War photographs, and I just wanted to put those in so that you'd have them in your mind as a comparison to Mann's images. So in Mann's images, specks of dust and damage to the glass surface of her negatives create drips, puddles, and comets that evoke smoke, the heat and screams of battle, and flying bullets. Old equipment allows light flares and leaks. In some photographs, the perspective seems almost ground level, as if the earth itself is telling us what it felt like to be the site of all this horror and death. In Battlefield Manassas, veins, that's this image, dark spots on a thin strip of glowing horizon suggest the rising spirits of the dead. In Battlefield Antietam, Last Light, this image beckons with painterly abstraction as drifts of ghostly smoke suggest a faint sky above a dark and marred earth. And bare branches like skeletal hands reach into the top of the frame to gesture at the place where they lost their flesh. There is beauty, but not glory here, in man's dark and elemental conjuring of scarred fields and groves and blood-soaked earth. So this is part four, the last part. Actually, I think that means it's part five, sorry. Part five. I want to end today by circling back to the present and to some of Mann's new work, her image of Black Sanctuary, the grids of African-American churches and the tintypes of swamps and riverbanks on display in the part of the show called Abide With Me. Small Southern churches are everywhere in American photography. Wooden churches with peeling or fresh white paint, country churches, churches squeezed between city buildings or taking over storefronts, churches for whites and churches for blacks. Farm security photographers shot them often, and this image was taken by Jack Delano near Greensboro, Alabama in 1941. Evans could not resist their vernacular architecture, and I could spend the rest of the day showing you pictures that Evans took of churches across the South, but here's a brief selection. Eudora Welty also photographed churches, especially African-American churches. Here's an image she took in Jackson, Mississippi in the mid-1930s. Somehow, Welty got her camera inside a black sanctuary and actually enticed people to pose. She even got pictures of services in progress, including this one entitled Speaking the Unknown Tongue, Jackson, 1939. All these years later, I still cannot fathom the contradictory combination of audacity and sympathy, given Welty's whiteness, that it must have required for her to take these pictures. Emmett Gowan in the 60s returned to this topic and made photographs of black churches in the countryside of Virginia as well as in Richmond between 1963 and 1965. And some of this work made it into his undergraduate thesis at what was then Richmond Professional Institute and is now VCU. And here are some of Gowan's church images. This one is actually from Richmond, as is this one. In the last decade, Mann, too, has discovered churches. What is it about white Southern photographers and black churches, I want to ask? What makes photographers return again and again to this subject? Churches were rare black-controlled spaces in the segregated South, and many churches founded there still survive as buildings and also as active congregations. Churches have been and remain the center of much of rural Southern life. And churches themselves are places of return. Going to church produces its own set of rituals, bathing and dressing up and traveling to the building. Services revolve around rituals and repetitions, an ordering of prayers and songs and Bible readings and sermons. Christian theology, too, takes shape around return. Jesus arising from the dead, Jesus returning to earth, believers returning to heaven. Churches are also the sites of dinner on the grounds, homecomings and reunions, weddings and funerals. All this ritual and repetition link a collective of people in the present to those in the past and project the outline of their social existence into the future. Churches are an essential place that people make and mark their history. Man seems to be trying here to grapple with the Black Southern experience, with what these places and pasts look like from the other side of the color line. She also displays in the show at the National Gallery a series of large and exquisite tintypes, along with these grids of Black churches. Their reflective surfaces turn swamps and riverbanks where trees meet water into mirrored silhouettes whose multiplying images include saplings and vines and the very faces of the viewers. They seem to float in that blurry space between myth and the world, as wall text reveals that she has made these images along the Blackwater and the Nottoway Rivers, Nat Turner's old territory, and in the Dismal Swamp, long a place of refuge for enslaved people hiding from their owners. What whites saw as wasteland of scrub and water and mud, Blacks saw as sanctuary. In the past, Black and white oppression and freedom stood as mirrored images. Slavery and segregation meant that one side's loss was another side's gain. Mann's recent work, including the portraits that are also on display at the National Gallery of Black men, make us think about whether there is some other way to imagine the form of these relationships. Yet in making Black history visible on the landscape, Mann, like so many white artists, leaves unexamined the Black presence in the history of art, and more specifically, the history of photography, that is such an important aspect of her work. What would it look like, I ask, to make this history too visible? To make art that grappled not just with the history of Black lives, but with the history of Black image making. The circle then takes us back. Time is mainly pictures, the Southern white writer Reynolds Price has said, and after a while, it is only pictures. The linear grand narratives are dead. Return suggests another shape for historical narratives, another form. The circle enables us to go back and unravel the web of events, to get to the decisive moment, a concept that photography itself taught us to see. The act of return is powerful. By going back and looking at something again, maybe we can see where it all went wrong. Maybe we can unwind it. Maybe we can pinpoint that one essential and probably photographed moment, return to it, and then move forward again in a different path. Maybe we can keep troubling the past until we figure out a new future. Alternately, by going back and looking at something again, maybe we can see where things went right. Maybe we can see the Gowan family, the Mann family, the forgiving light on a church front shot by Walker Evans, or the spirits of the Civil War dead shot by Sally Mann. Yeah, if you have a question, probably you should just stand up and speak loudly. Yes, thanks.
Well, thank you for that very illuminating talk. I've been looking at these pictures a long time and always learn something new. Sort of given the question that you closed on, I wanted to circle back. Can anybody hear me? I wanted to circle back to something you said that I think was really powerful and I think also open to more exploration. And we're specifically speaking about the photograph of the Edmonton Riverbank man is essentially performing a kind of artistic reparation. And I thought that was a very powerful way of thinking about it, but I think one could also see it as a form of co-optation.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that that's, you know, one of the issues that these pictures in this show brings up, and I just would like to hear kind of some more of your thoughts or other people in the audience.
Well, I think that one of the things that is really powerful about, I mean, this is one of the things that our history as Americans and our long history of white supremacy, one of the things that that leaves us with is that we don't actually come to understanding history, viewing images, going to see an art exhibition, we come at that from very different places and positions. And we don't all know the same things, and we don't all see things in the same ways because of the powerful ways in which that history of white supremacy has shaped us. And so for me, seeing those images, I was reminded of the fact that the vast majority of people of African descent in this country wouldn't need any kind of reminder about the violence of white American, you know, white supremacy. I mean, they just don't need to be reminded of that. I actually spent the morning at the new African American Culture and History Museum of History and Culture, and obviously all of this is on display right there on the mall. So that really struck me when I was looking at these Emmett Till pictures that you know, what would be, what else could be on offer here besides that reminder, right? Because that's not a reminder. It is a reminder, though, very much a reminder that many white Americans need to have, right? Many white Americans need that reminder, perhaps even daily. And so what is an artist then to do, right? What is an artist to do when different audiences come with different information and different histories and different burdens and need different information? And so in thinking about that and struggling with it, that's what struck me, that these images that she makes, that she relates to Emmett Till, which of course we wouldn't know they're related to Till if she didn't put that in the parentheses, because there's no way to tell from the images themselves. But those images are exactly the same. They're the same tone, the same coloring, everything about them aesthetically fits with this Deep South body of images. And that made me think about how powerful it is to see those images next to a ruin of a plantation. Because a ruin of a plantation is an image that can go either way, right? This can be a ruin that we celebrate or a ruin that we mourn. You know, depending on your politics and your perspective and your sort of understanding of your past, you know, some people might see that and say, that's something to mourn, the passing of this old South. Others would say, you know, that was an abomination. We have to, you know, that's great that it's a ruin. That's what it should be. So to me, those images are really risky, and the Emmett Till images being in the same body of work with those images, the narrative that is made between them is absolutely important, it seems to me, and central to what Mann's trying to do here, because singly, the ruined plantation can say something that I don't think Mann intends for it to say, much as Laughlin's picture that I showed, the Enigma, really can sort of reanimate, you know, the romance of the Old South. But paired, to me, that was the key. It's the fact that they're all the same body of work, and paired, that suggests something really powerful. Now, I guess you could say in that answer, I've sidestepped your question, which is, I think essentially you're asking in a very nice way, does Sally Mann have a right to make images of these sites connected with Emmett Till? It's not for me to say that, I don't think. And by saying that, I am not doing the thing that academics love to do, I guess, which is to dodge the hard question. I really sincerely mean that. I think it is not for any of us to tell an artist what they should make their work about. We can reject it. We can say we don't like it. We can say we don't want to look at it. We can say we find it ugly. But I don't think it is my place to say that she can't make that art for any reason, including that because she's a white person. But I think that it is the body of that Deep South work that really makes the Emmett Till picture so powerful, because I've not seen another artist give that same kind of aesthetic treatment and have that kind of romantic sort of imagery associated with that kind of a site of black loss. And that to me was powerful. So I don't know if that, sorry, that might be too long-winded, but I don't know if that answers your question. But if people in the audience want to weigh in on this or jump in, so somebody up here wants to say something, please jump in.
Not to that, but I don't think we have that much time, but thanks for mentioning both Ralph Meekard and Eggleston. And I'm wondering if you say something about the images that he's created with masks and Halloween masks, often in rural settings and cemeteries against these very southern feeling wards, so to speak. And also Eggleston, who's also described as some of his color photography, which is what he's really been known for, you know, in terms of angry reds and that sort of thing, colors that really pulsate with it's almost a strobic kind of quality, hurt and loss and these sort of things. Really those veiling thing going on in each art and a veiling kind of thing going on in each
art,
we speak to that. And even in the suburban streets, they seem to be calm, but they are grotesque, there's a grotesquery going on.
No, that's great. I don't think I can do this question justice, but with Meat Yard, I think what's interesting in some ways to me is when you look at Mann's pictures, Deep South, and her battlefields, it's almost like she's doing with her flawed negatives and drips and places where the negatives are messed up. She's doing in a much more subtle way. What Meat Yard is doing, which is trying to explore this kind of haunted past and these kinds of ways in which we mask and hide our feelings about things, and the really kind of complicated layeredness of Southern history. So it's almost like she's done it without the kind of explicit imagery. I mean, Meat Yard in that sense too is interesting in relation to Laughlin and his work, which I think is even more explicit than, I mean, Meat Yard is subtle in comparison to him. So I think that's a really interesting way to think about their work. I could say more, but I don't think we have time. And the other question about William Eggleston, I didn't talk about Eggleston today because I think that Eggleston in some ways is a bit of an outlier, even though this is some of the people that I've talked about today, they're making work at the same time that Eggleston is making his work. I don't find in Eggleston really any attempt to grapple with Southern whiteness and the privilege and the burden and the violence. I find his work aesthetically very interesting and I'm very compelled by it, but I think that he really is blind, not just blind in the way that all white people are blind, but even more blind than most white people. And I think you see that in the famous image of I feel like it's his father or his uncle with his black male driver standing behind him. And that image to me just is so powerful and compelling, but there is nothing in it that's a critique of that relationship. It almost seems like a celebration of it. So that's why I didn't talk about Eggleston today, but his work is certainly compelling. Yeah. Yes, please. Just stand up, yeah.
I won't stand, but I'll speak loudly. I just wanted to say I'm reading Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, right now, which is about the Great Migration north and west from the South from the 20th century. And so thinking about this idea of returning to the South, I'm kind of thinking too about maybe there's a difference between white Americans returning to the South and black Americans who spent so much time fleeing the South, returning, and then thinking about Emmett Till and the case in which a young boy returned and such a brutal death awaited him. So I just wonder if there's some complicating maybe to that question of return that you really laid out so well for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's actually interesting about the Great Migration is that it really is a parallel white and black migration. As many actually more numerically speaking, white people are moving out of the South at the same time as blacks. And both of those groups of people going to the Midwest, going to California, some to the Northeast, but in both populations returning, especially of children, to spend summers with grandparents while parents are working is something that is happening. And so even in no way to suggest that those histories, you know, that there's not racial conflict and racism at work, but in that process of return, there is a lot also of similarity. That process of sending relatives back. Now, of course, what is hugely different is that if you send your white teenage son back to Mississippi for the summer, he's not in danger of being lynched. And so that certainly is one key difference. But it is interesting. Sometimes I think much of my career has been focused on thinking about difference and about white supremacy. And sometimes I think it behooves us, and sometimes I think artists can help us to do this, to think about connections and similarities without in any way denying the racism and white supremacy and all of that, but also looking at places of connection and commonality. And I personally see that in this act of return, of coming back. So I don't really know how else to address your question, but you know, again, not to discount the fact that there is certainly that the difference of the violence people face. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.